You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello and welcome to the Football Fanalytics podcast in association with 23. This is the show that explores the ever-growing world of football analytics and takes on the many tactical and topical discussions within the game. It's episode 66 and we are talking about formations this week. My name is Ryan Bailey and joining me is Mark Carey, a man who has recently returned from the Stats Bomb. What do you call it? The Stats Bomb what conference?
Stats Bomb conference, Ryan.
Just the Stats Bomb conference. Not the Stats Bomb Ultra conference or something like that. It's the Stats Bomb conference. It's the last time we saw
If only it were, other. Yeah, something different. It's
is it an ultra conference?
I mean, yeah, if only it were. But no, I had a great time at the conference earlier this week. So a lot of familiar faces of people that fortunately I know within the football analytics space and met a few new people, which was hugely enjoyable. Met a few fans of the Football Fanalytics podcast, which is nice. So shout out to Michael and to Mead, who came up to me very kindly and said that they are a fan of the work that we do. Keep up the good work. So
wow,
a little pat on the back for both of us there. So yeah, it's really fun to see and to know that the work that we're doing, the fun that we're having is reaching people and hopefully helping people in terms of their analytics journey, which is great to see and to hear. So yeah, shout out to those guys, and for anyone else who enjoys our work or wants us to do other topics on this podcast, then get in touch. They know how to do it.
This is the most celebrity like I've ever felt. Two people coming up to you at a conference and saying they like the Football Fanalytics podcast. So yeah, I'll take that.
There we go. Nothing to do with my work, just our work.
Yeah. Well, obviously. In my head, a Stats Bomb conference like that, you know, when they get all the world leaders in like the Pentagon or something like that in like films, and then it's like, what happens if there's a nuclear attack on like where all the world leaders are? Is that like the same with all the basically the analytics people in the world are in one space just like doing it, and then it's left to people like me? You all go down.
I mean, to carry on flying the flag. I'd love to say yes. I'd love to say that there was extensive security to ensure that we were protected for the
whole
day.
That's Tom Warville.
Yeah, but sadly not. I never actually thought of it like that. No, I don't place that much importance on necessarily the work that I certainly do, but maybe for others in the room, there were some big names there, to be fair. I was fanboying a little bit, even from people I didn't get to speak to, but just recognising their face. So yeah.
Turns out people are fanboying you as well, which is great.
Well, us, shall we say. Yeah. But no, honestly, it was such a good conference. It's good to obviously see the talks, the research that's going on, sort of learn so much from it. But I think as much as anything, it is just the networking of chatting with people in those breaks and after the conference to just share ideas and share how everyone's getting on. So yeah, really productive day. And yeah, made my ego a little bit bigger, which is always helpful.
Excellent. Well, I'm trying to think what other news I've got that comes close to a good conference. I think the biggest thing I can think of is that I've played my last ever game of FIFA 22. that's literally it. Because FIFA 23 gets released this week.
Would you ever? Would you ever go back? Like, have you ever played like FIFA 17?
No. Do you know what though? There are some years which I think this is gameplay wise. One of the best, which I actually think FIFA 22 has been that. I don't know if that's a controversial opinion or not. FIFA 20 was awful.
Right.
Or was it FIFA 21 that was awful? One of the 20 or 21 was really bad. Yeah. It was really sort of robotic and weird gameplay, but 22 has been really good. But no, I find that it bothers me if the sort of the lineups and the teams are, you know, dated. I play FIFA Ultimate Team, which means that you wouldn't be playing against anyone else because everyone else moves on to the new FIFA. So, yeah, a little bit. Although this one, I think this is the last ever FIFA that they're doing. The one they've released this year. I think EA Sports are no longer going to be associated with FIFA. It's going to be now under a different umbrella. It was in the news a couple of months ago that their agreement has ended. So FIFA as we know it. Yeah, FIFA as we know it and love it. Comes to an end this year. So this is the final ever one. I don't know if they're going to be pulling out all the stops or whatever, but it will become a new umbrella game, basically. So you will no longer be saying, oh, do you want a game of FIFA? You'll be saying, do you want a game of whatever it's called?
Insert line here. I mean, we should do an episode on FIFA. That could be really good, especially given the metrics that go into all of the, you know, the FIFA games and the ratings and all things like that. We should try and do an episode on it.
Yeah, they last year, I think I told you in another episode, they introduced obviously expected goals, things like that, but you can kind of see like shot maps and pass maps and average positions and stuff, which is quite strange when you're watching it to a FIFA audience. They still obviously have the classic rating system, which is good. Which actually, I was gonna do a little cheeky little quiz on the ratings because there's been a few controversial ones. Fun fact: the highest rated player on FIFA 23 is Alexia?
I did know Alexia Putellas, yes.
Alexia Putellas, who we obviously saw live last year. But I think Messi is rated 91 on FIFA, and she is rated 92, which means she's technically the highest player on the game, which I thought was quite good.
Unfortunately injured, so we wish her all the best.
But quick higher or lower for you. I'm not just going to do the top ones. You basically have to tell me who is higher or lower out of these players. I'm going to look at this image here. Right.
So are we going with this? You're going to present me two people, or are you going to start with one and their rating
I'm going to start off with one rating, and you have to tell me if these people are higher or lower.
Fine.
I'm going to start off with Alphonso Davies of Bayern Munich. He is rated 84.
Okay.
94 pace, which is quite a fun fact. Makes sense. But yeah, Alphonso Davies. I haven't said another name. waiting for that to come out. Yeah.
Ready when you are.
Brilliant. Christian Pulisic.
Okay. So then 84. I would say lower. I'd say Pulisic maybe 82.
Ooh, okay. He's actually 82. Bravo.
Are you joking?
Yeah, I swear,
I promise you, I've got nothing in front of me. This is great.
You're looking at the same FIFA image as me. Jude Bellingham.
I was going to say he's got to be higher. I think he would be higher. Still, obviously, very young, which may be playing into it. He might be, and I promise you, I'm not looking at anything, 86, so I'd say higher?
No, he is higher, but he is 84.
Okay.
Which I think, I don't know, I think for someone who's still... They never go too bold with their ratings. I mean, they never drop or raise someone too high. I think you could argue that Jude Bellingham actually in real life could warrant a higher sort of card, couldn't you? But I think because he's 19 and it's only like his third season of playing top level, I think they'd never go too bold. Another youngster, though, Pedri of Barcelona.
Pedri, again, very, very well thought of. Then 84, despite what you just said, and given that he is very young as well, I would say maybe 86. So higher.
It's higher, but 85.
Okay.
86 would be bold.
Sticking to Jack even Grealish. Numbers. Jack Grealish, because he is more well-established, I'd say... Well, actually, no, because we're getting pretty high now, aren't we?
86 is pretty high. Getting
pretty high. Well, it was higher than 85, wasn't it? I'd maybe say lower then.
This is turning into a shit game because you're getting them all right. He is lower, yes.
What yeah, number?
He's 84, which I think on the last FIFA he was higher than that. So that's interesting. Damn it, I need to trip you up.
I love this game.
Okay, actually then, I'm not sure which way you're going to go with this. Kai Havertz.
Kai Havertz compared with 84. Well, it's impacted upon sort of the season they've had. So I'd say lower, maybe 81.
Oh, no. He's actually also 84.
That's just unfair.
Well, you could have said the same. 81, though, it would be pretty harsh, wouldn't it? Kai Havertz. Although he's 84.
I suppose,
great season.
Yeah, probably early 80s. I mean, can I just say for the record, we're playing the game higher or lower, and you said the same. I think for the listeners, it should be on my side here that was a curveball. But fair.
Final one then. Who's higher out of Song Heung-min and Vinicius Jr.?
Oh, that is a good one. I'd give... The hype would be Vinicius, wouldn't it? But I'd give the edge to Son. I don't know the numbers, but I'd give the edge to Son.
You are correct. Can you get what the numbers would be?
I'd go... I'm just making this up. 86 versus 87.
No, 89 for Son, actually. All right, fair. Very highly rated. Fair. Within the top sort of 15, I think. Yeah. And Vinicius is 86.
Okay. 86. Yeah. So I got the 86 right then. 86 versus 87. Wow. I mean, that was fun.
You did very well. Basically, I realised that this game was going to be hard after I'd already started doing it, because I realised that of the 13 that I've got in front of me, 7 of them were 84. So I was like, I don't really have much higher or lower scope here to play, but I'd already started.
I mean, anyway. I suppose it's going right down the list. How low does it... Because you don't get someone who's like a 7, do you? I think, is the baseline, no. Is it 60 up?
I'm going to Google it, but no, it's not 60 up. I think it's in the 50s. Hang on. Lowest FIFA rating. Okay, well, I can't actually find it on Google, but that's actually a good question for the listeners then. If someone can find me the lowest player for FIFA 23, we'd like to know that. I know that on FIFA 22, there was a player called Collins who was 47.
Oh, right. Okay.
So I don't think they ever go any lower than that, because that'd be sort of... I always think, like, what, you know, if we were actual in real life, if we had a FIFA rating, like, would we be like 13 or something like that? Do you know what I mean?
I don't even think I'd make scale. I mean, certainly recently, not played for a year, but I don't think we'd even make a number. That's the level of how good they are that we wouldn't even make a number. I'd be like a 0.1.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah. No, give yourself a 0.2. It'd be nice. Anyway, enough of these shenanigans. Should we talk about what we're actually meant to be talking about?
Yeah, love that game, but let's get into some hard, cold facts.
Okay, so Mark, this strikes me as another one of those topics where perhaps it's a bit strange that we're at episode 66 and we haven't done a full episode on formations, which you kind of... Formations are always interspersed in general football chat, aren't they? But yeah, I'm surprised we haven't sort of done a formations specific chat up until this point.
Yeah, maybe not a dedicated one. Of course, we will have spoken about formations throughout all of the episodes that we've done, but not necessarily maybe a dedicated one. Episode 66, shout out to Trent Alexander-Arnold, by the way, just in terms of numbers, our boy, number 66.
Yeah.
Just because you mentioned it.
Well, he's a man who defies the formations, really, doesn't he? Because he's a right back. Did you do that on purpose?
Absolutely not.
He's a right back, but he finds himself sitting in central midfield, doing whatever he wants of late.
Absolutely unintentional, but it is absolutely the crux of this episode, which is more of, a thought experiment to basically pose the question, are formations even reliable anymore? And when I say reliable, I mean when you're looking at, you know, a starting formation, you know, whether it's a team sheet, whether you're looking on an app or online as to how the team is set up, is that a reliable source of information to actually understand what the team is looking to do in that game?
Well, it feels like it's kind of like it's a purpose that when they're lined up on TV and it tells you the pre-match formation, it feels like that is basically for them to run through the team, doesn't it? As opposed to the ironclad what it's going to be. Because very often you'll see they've put down what they think the formation mm-hmm. is going to be, and very quickly it's apparent that they're not doing that at all.
Yeah, which is true, which is, could be a reflection of the modern game. Is it that it was kind of more reliable in years gone by, or has it always been sort of fairly fluid? And we'll kind of unpick why we might say that, thinking about things like in possession, out of possession, the game state, whether it is winning, losing, drawing, whether you're down to 10 players, you know what I mean? So many different factors, of course, there. But yeah, are they reliable? I mean, I was looking about this before this episode, and I saw a quote from Pep Guardiola saying that formations are nothing more than telephone numbers.
Of course Guardiola would say that.
I don't know how true that was that he said that, but it's quoted with him, which I think would kind of make sense. And I think that it's one of those as well where, as you say, if you see it on the television before the game, sometimes they do get it wrong. But if you were to actually obviously be in the stadium or have a screenshot of the players on the pitch at a moment in time, in or out of possession, which again is an interesting point, would you see a 4-2-3-1? Would you see a 4-4-2 of how that team is intended to set up based on what you kind of infer? The roles of different players are going to be completely different for a right back, as you say. Like the remit of Trent Alexander-Arnold as a right back versus Vladimir Sofal, again, depending on whether he's playing right back, right wing back, whatever, is going to be very different. 4-4-2 for one side might be completely different in terms of the remit and the approach in and out of possession for another, whether it is a 4-4-2 diamond, whatever it might be. You know, a 4-3-3, for example, is that having two holding midfielders in a double pivot? Is it having a single pivot where the remit of that defensive midfielder is to collect the ball off the centre backs, they spread out, the full backs go wide? You know, what is the remit of that? It does kind of show that the numbers associated with formations are kind of useless in giving information of what that team is going to do in that game.
Absolutely. And also didn't realise how relevant the FIFA chat would have been on this particular topic, because that's the first thing you do, select your formation with whatever team you're playing, which I think is probably a bit more rigid than it is in real life, because you rarely get people just floating into centre mid when you want them to. But yes, really good point. And actually that thing you say about in possession and out of possession, that's something that I think before we started doing this podcast, I never really would have thought too much about. But you'd see a total shift, don't you, when someone has the ball to when they don't in what they're playing. Because I think it was Man City, I saw a screenshot months and months ago, but it was basically saying that when they have the ball, they essentially play with like a sort of a weird five up front. Mm-hmm. It becomes a five and a five, or a four and a six, basically, mm-hmm. rather than them sticking to three midfielders and three attackers. Mm-hmm. Because the soon as they get the ball, their sort of system and their coaching changes, and they know exactly when they've got possession with a certain player what they're meant to do because of what they've done on the training field. So therefore, it's almost like a formation movement, do you know what I mean? They move into these specific roles that they're then meant to play, which doesn't fall in the categories of left midfielder or whatever.
No, completely.
Does that make sense?
Completely. It's patterns of play. It's principles of play that all managers, I suppose, like to have, but especially with Guardiola, he likes his wide attackers to pretty much hug the touchline, get really wide so that he can stretch the pitch, make sure that then the opposition's fullbacks, wingbacks, whoever, then have to kind of try and plug the gap. Then he gets those free eights within those half spaces to then cover those sort of middle areas. So you got two in the wide channels, two in the half space, and then kind of one centrally, so that you've got players all across the pitch to be able to occupy, you know, opposition defenders or opposition midfielders, whoever it may be. So that then, as you say, kind of ends up being, if you think about then the centre backs will stay as the two, maybe those wing backs, maybe those full backs will then tuck in as Guardiola likes them to do, and then the holding midfielder. So in attack, Manchester City are a 2-3-5. Now you would never see it written down. Oh, Man City are in a 2-3-5 formation today. It seems odd. Yeah. But that's exactly the point that I'm making, that in and out of possession, it's completely different. And a lot of Premier League sides maybe would go into a five in midfield, maybe out of possession. But you think of Liverpool, I think, do this. Arsenal certainly do it, where Martin Odegaard especially will end up being a little bit more sort of push forward, but Arsenal out of possession would be a 4-4-2. you can see. I've seen it multiple times where they've been like this, and obviously they were more playing in a 4-2-3-1, now more of a 4-3-3 if we were going to do it in traditional methods this season. But out of possession, they look more like a 4-4-2, and rarely would we ever say Arsenal are setting up in a 4-4-2 today. So I just think that there's so much, as is often the case, which is why we do this podcast, there's so much nuance and so many things to consider when we're talking about formations, which does beg the question, are they becoming redundant because it is so fluid?
Yeah, well, it feels like those things that you said before, you know, the terms like 3-8, double pivot, etc. It's almost like the roles that managers sort of deploy are more important than the actual formation, doesn't it? They might not, it might not care whether they're a 4-3-3 on paper at the start of the match, but they know that within that they have 2 3-8s and they have a sit and hold the midfielder who's going to screen the defence, etc. So that therefore those roles that they sort of want from their team become more important, don't they?
Yeah, and I think it's drilling down from what we're talking about here onto to the players as well. So we say our formation's redundant, quote unquote. Are positions also redundant when you're talking more about roles? Yeah. So would a defensive midfielder, you compare someone like Wilfred Ndidi, whose job it is to pretty much break up the play, be a bit of a defensive destroyer, and then hand it to someone who can pass a little bit more, like a Yuri Tielemans. You compare that with someone who's more of a deep-lying playmaker. I think someone maybe like Sergio Busquets, traditionally, who, granted, has a lot of defensive awareness, but is far more graceful on the ball, being able to play these sort of slider or passes into more advanced players. They are both, again, quote unquote, number sixes, defensive midfielders, but their remit is completely different for what their role is within the team. So how could you compare like for like if you were looking at all the defensive midfielders across Europe? It's so dependent on what they're being asked to do, which makes it really hard to look at things from a statistical perspective to say that they are in maybe this percentile of defensive midfielders. It's like, well, you know, of course they're going to be for a certain metric because they're not asked to do a lot of that. You know, they're not asked to do a lot of progressive passing, for example. You know what I mean?
Which is where those radar things that you've done before come in handy, don't they? About the, you know, profiling certain players that, you know, do certain bits. And
exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Good shout, actually. Going back to some of the early episodes.
That's right. I said the word radar.
Yeah. Where we spoke. That's right. Yeah. Spoke about, analyses that I've done of profiling different midfielders, and something which we've actually done on site on The Athletic fairly recently. John Muller has done some fantastic work at looking at player roles and how much a player can evolve as well over time to say that, okay, well, they used to be this sort of player. Maybe like a Jude Bellingham, for example. He's so versatile. Yeah. He was more of a defensively minded midfielder a couple of seasons ago. Now he's a bit more of a, he roams a bit more box to box and things like that. So I think exactly as you say, it speaks to more of an individual level of what a player's role is. But you broaden that out and it's still the same principle of what the team is being asked to do as a formation. Yeah. 2-4-3-3s could be completely different.
Absolutely. And I wonder, is when we're talking about formations, how much do trends come into it and stuff like that? Because it'd be really interesting to look at the change in, you know, in the 90s and whatever, when 4-4-2 was the most prevalent thing going. When do you think that changed? When managers started sort of experimenting more and it became more about tactical roles and positioning rather than, oh, today we're playing with one up top and five at the back and blah, blah, blah.
I mean, I don't know the answer to that question. I was watching something recently with Joe Cole was doing an interview with Harry Redknapp and he was talking about Harry Redknapp's time, well, Joe Cole's time at West Ham as well, of how they played with three at the back. This is probably going back to late 90s, maybe early 2000s.
Yeah.
Played with three at the back, and he's like, you know, Thomas Tuchel, Antonio Conte coming into the Premier League in years gone by, and were supposed to be these tactical innovators who play three at the back, and it's completely different. He said we were doing that in the late 90s, and I don't want to disrespect football historically to suggest that that isn't the case or hasn't been the case, because we've spoken before about different formations. I think the WM formation, and spoken about Hungary and how innovative they were. Remembering that that England destruction in the 50s. So as we've always said before, football didn't start 10 years ago.
Wasn't invented 10 years ago.
Exactly. So it's considering all of those things as well. But there's obviously going to be tactical evolutions. There's going to be cycles as well, where I think you know, you look at this season, Erling Haaland coming into the Premier League, Darwin Nunez to a certain extent being having a bit more of a number nine out and out striker, centre forward presence has maybe changed the way that these top teams are playing, rather than it being more geared towards a false nine in years gone by. So, you know,
we should remember then that became a thing for the first time. That when it always comes down to Pep, doesn't it? It's so annoying. You always have to be like, oh, another Guardiola thing. But annoyingly, half the time it is. But what, you know, sort of around 2009 when Messi was playing in like a false nine, and then that's what the Spanish teams did. It was such a thing, wasn't it, that we hadn't heard of. Whereas now we're going the opposite. It's almost like, oh, they're playing with a natural number nine striker. Wow. Yeah.
Well, it's whatever you need to do, again, which feeds into the formation thing. It's whatever you need to do to overcome the opponent. And sometimes the opponent can work out that if you're going to play in a false nine every time, then we can think of ways to combat that, or, you know, stick two defensive midfielders in front of the false nine so there's less space for them to drop in or whatever it might be. And now he's trying to think of different ways to do that as well. And again, coming back to the formation thing, you think, well, it's never set in terms of how a manager will always set up in a 4-3-3. Game to game, depending on the opponent, they'll set up in that 4-3-3 slightly differently. They'll maybe gear it more towards one side, whatever it might be, that no two games are obviously the same. And that's the manager's job to be able to try and break that down. And is it that if... I mean, we had it, I think, last season. I'm trying to think of the exact game, but it might have been Chelsea against Spurs where there was an adaptation where... Or maybe it was this season as well. Tuchel versus Conte, basically. I think that the one adapted to the other to know that obviously Conte plays very systematically in a 3-4-3, previously sort of a 3-5-2, but certainly three at the back, that you can... one. Basically, the point being, a team can typically play, for example, in a 4-3-3, but knowing full well that the opposition is set up in a maybe a three at the back system, you can change that formation specifically for that game and maybe change it back within the game as well. I think that Graham Potter is very good at that, starting a game in a certain position, realizing that this might not be working. There was a game, I think, Brighton against Fulham earlier this season, which I wrote about earlier this month, that he started off with a four at the back, or maybe started off with a three at the back, actually. That wasn't working at all against Fulham. So he moved to a four within about 15 minutes. That you can have that fluidity. On paper, that would say that Brighton started with three at the back. But very quickly, that changed because of what was happening in the game and the strength of the opponent. So, yeah, it's probably a long-winded answer to what you sort of said. But I think that there's just so much nuance to it. That how a team finishes in a formation can be very different to how they start it. How they play in possession can be very different to how they play out of possession. Whether they're winning or drawing can be very different to how they set when they're losing. Again, I ask the question to you, Ryan, are formations redundant?
Well, that feels like a much deeper question than I thought about at the beginning of this episode. So let me think about that one. Mark, this is exciting. Why don't you tell the listeners about our new collaboration with Spitch? Tell them what Spitch is.
So, Spitch is basically a live fantasy football manager app, and you can pit yourself against other managers, basically. And the fun thing is that you can win real money in the process. And what's great is that you can compete across multiple leagues worldwide. So rather than just the Fantasy Premier League that we do, you can compete in other leagues like the German Bundesliga, the Premier League, of course, and others like the Champions League and the Europa League.
I mean, if it was like Fantasy Premier League, then we'd win absolutely nothing. But it's not like Fantasy Premier League because the difference is you can create a brand new lineup for each match day. So basically, no more selection regret when a player you've chosen is going through a bad run of form. And what else is different, Mark?
Well, I think it's right up our street because it goes into greater depth with the analytics side, which is so true to the Football Fanalytics podcast. So it awards points for basically every action on the pitch. So things like passes, tackles, blocks and shots, everything that you can think of, all count towards your match score.
So for the first time ever, we can cheer on a pot shot from miles away.
Exactly.
So make sure you sign up, download the app and register now. Once you've registered, you can join the Football Fanalytics Podcast League. So come and get involved, play against me and Mark. The link is in our bio. Join Spitch now. Something I did want to ask about, I've very often seen graphics and visualizations, the analytics community, and in the more mainstream, to be fair, average position maps. That's always fun, isn't it, when you look at those? And some of them you would struggle to put in any kind of formation, wouldn't you? Especially when you're watching a Liverpool or someone, and Roberto Firmino has been deeper than the two centre midfielders for most of the game on his average position map. How do they work? How do they put those average position maps together?
Fairly simply, really. It's all based on on-ball events, which is the key point which we can come on to. But every time the player touches the ball, whether that's an attacking action, defensive action, it logs it and you get the XY coordinates, so essentially the location on the pitch of where that was, and you just aggregate it all together, get an average of where those actions were made, and that is the player's average position, which I think sometimes when you see players almost on top of each other, it can be a little bit misleading. The passing networks, which is what these are, very well established within football analytics. They are very useful for the most part, but they can be, I guess, susceptible to error slightly. An example of that might be that a player might be playing left wing for, and we saw it a lot with England in the Women's Euros, that Lauren Hemp and Beth Mead would be sometimes swapping wings, right? During the first half of games. Now, if you were to sort of create an average, it would look like they were maybe somewhere in between the middle.
Playing up front.
Playing in a position that wasn't representative of what they were actually doing, which was switching wings. Mm. So sometimes it can be a little bit misleading. And as I say, it only looks at on-ball events. So when I said about that Odegaard example where Arsenal will tuck into a 4-4-2, it completely will disregard that. They might be still offering value off the ball, but their average position isn't actually shown because they're not actually having an event on the ball, so it doesn't actually log
it.
So there's it's a good indicator, but not necessarily the be-all and end-all to show what they were doing on the pitch.
It can be quite interesting sometimes, though, can't it, when there's a drastic change within the average positions from like the first half to the second half, for instance, and it shows that they pushed the wing backs a lot higher, or they were sitting a lot deeper, or whatever. There are some things it can kind of tell you sometimes, which is quite interesting to look at.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think that the passing network graphic also shows the strength of the connection, it being a network, between certain players. Mm. So if you can see it geared far more towards maybe the left-hand side, from the left centre-back to the left wing-back or full-back, and the left central midfielder, you can see, if you weren't to have watched the game, you can see that that team really looked to try and expose the opponent's right-hand side by really giving the ball more towards the left. So it does give a flavour as to what has happened within the game. But as we often say, and we've spoken about before, there are so many, in general, advanced metrics to be able to understand what happened within the game. And it's a good tool to be able to look at it.
This question is probably quite redundant, considering the fact we've just said that formations don't mean anything in lots of ways. But if you were a manager and you had your tactical philosophy, are there any things that you think you would definitely try and implement? So, for instance, like, I personally think I'd always try and have three central midfielders, because I was watching England last Friday, obviously play against Italy, and having the two central midfielders, albeit that they were Declan Rice and Jude Bellingham, both very good players. You've already mentioned Jude Bellingham being sort of versatile and box to box. But it felt like they were just completely overran in the middle of midfield, didn't it? Regardless what role they were playing, it looked like Jude Bellingham didn't know what role he was sort of meant to be playing, whether he was meant to be deep or if he was sort of meant to be driving forward. But then he obviously kind of left Declan Rice quite exposed when he did. So it always feels to me like, whether you're in possession or out of possession, I would always want three central midfielders, one of which being... At least one of which being a defensive midfielder. I always like the idea of having a sort of single pivot defensive midfielder and then two central midfielders to do what you want with them, free ace, etc. But I think that'd always be a non-negotiable for me. Do you have any of those?
Yeah, well, just thinking off the top of my head now, I totally agree with that. I think probably just as an aside, I went a bit too strong on our formations redundant. I probably,
a quote from Mark Carey, formations don't mean anything.
Yeah, a bit too strong. It was more of a thought experiment, as I say. But I do think it's a valid question. And you think about like 4-4-2 being historically, or less used now, but historically more of a common formation. That issue might not necessarily have been one had it been playing against another side that also has two in midfield, if that makes sense. But then would that even reinforce your point even more to say, if you do have three in midfield, then you will then overrun the opponent if they had two. If they have three, then at least you want to match the number of midfielders they have, because otherwise you will get overrun. So I do think it's a valid point. I'd probably go along with that, to be perfectly honest. I'd say that. I'd probably want a team with a lot of width as well.
Yeah.
I do like the idea of a 3-5-2 for that reason. But then again, it just depends on the opponent, doesn't it? That's what I think is really interesting. We've spoken before about sort of active managers who are more likely to take the game to the opponent and just have their philosophy, their way of playing. And the more reactive managers like a Carlo Ancelotti or maybe a Jose Mourinho, who is going to adapt their formation, their style of play, depending on the opponent, try and expose their weaknesses and minimise their strengths. So I don't know also then which type of manager I'd be. Would I be someone who's a bit more reactive than necessarily your way? I don't know. But I think, without necessarily pinning my colours to the mast, I do think I like the idea of the way that Guardiola does do it, where you can still have like protection within the middle of the pitch without necessarily having three midfielders who are going to maybe stay in that area the counter attack. And one way obviously to do that is what he does quite frequently, to have his fullbacks kind of tuck into more central areas, such that if they were to lose the ball, they've still got the numbers basically there to not get overrun or counter-attack through kind of central areas and leave the centre-backs exposed. So I'd probably say that could be a good tactic within that as a bit of a nuance. But yeah, I'd say three. I do like the idea of having a single defensive midfielder and sort of two free eights, as we say in the modern day, because otherwise you do get overrun, and it's so obvious otherwise. You're just shooting yourself in the foot, aren't you?
And there's just a lack of creativity. I mean, three centre-backs anyway, and then two wing-backs who don't play as attackers is just a lot of defenders, isn't it? And which I think is what, in that England game I was referring to, it felt a little bit like that's how it was, even though Saka obviously tried to get quite high and it didn't quite work. And it just didn't really work, did it? But yeah, it's all interesting.
No, which doesn't bode well for the World Cup at all. Maybe that's another thing we should do in advance of the World Cup. We've got to do some World Cup previews, haven't we? Because it's, you know, these past few days has been all thinking about international football. It's not too far. It's only a matter of weeks until we think about the World Cup. So I do think this sort of conversation as well, thinking about formations and how you can adapt in such a short space of time within a World Cup, could be crucial. So an evergreen episode, I think, that we've just recorded, Ryan, but how relevant it might be to the World Cup coming up.
Absolutely. Well, that's definitely something we can look into in the future. I'd say our bank of things that we should have spoke about but haven't spoke about till certain episode thing that we keep going on about. Maybe we're running low now, but formations definitely does seem like a biggie we missed, but I'm glad we did that because, it was good fun, that one. I wonder what else we haven't spoke about that is an absolute glaring obvious one. Maybe if the listeners can think of anything, they can let us know at this moment.
Absolutely.
We left managers. Oh, hang on, refs. Refs is something we can do definitely at some point very soon, hopefully.
Yeah, definitely refs. Yeah. I mean, as I said, we've spoken about formations in different sort of guises before, but there's so much to go from, even with the managers thing as well. We could still talk about if a 4-4-2 set up against a 4-3-3, where would the advantages be? We sort of kind of just alluded to it then. If a 3-4-3 were to set up against a 4-5-1, whatever. So much more you could do with formations.
Absolutely. All food for thought, and listeners, as ever, get in touch and tell us what you want us to talk about. You know where you can do that. You can get in touch with us on email. We are fanalytics.pod@gmail.com, or you can follow us on social media and get in touch there. We are at fanalyticspod. Mark, thank you very much for your time. Let me know if there are anyone in the street who call you over and say, "Are you Mark Carey from the Football Fanalytics podcast?" Because that's the next step.
They'd have to hear me first.
They'll see you hobbling along and they'll be like, it must be him. Anyway, thank you very much for listening, everyone. Have a great rest of your week, and we will see you next time. Sports Social Podcast Network.